Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, it's Francis Lam here with a special podcast. On Friday, June 8th, America woke up to the awful news that Anthony Bourdain had died. Since then, the world, the food world, but really just the world, has been remembering and reflecting on the life of this truly unique person. And the tributes have been heartfelt and moving. The astronaut Scott Kelly said that he watched Tony's show from space and it made him feel more connected to our planet. The writer Michael Twitty admired Tony for being someone who used his platform to center the stories and voices of people of color and the invisible. The writer Rachel Kong said Tony's love of Malaysian food, where her family's from, made her finally feel understood. Even my wife got into a cab that night and the driver, out of the blue, just started talking to her about how much he loved that guy, Anthony Bourdain. I never knew him, and that's a lifelong regret that I'll have now. But reading the encomiums coming from pretty much everyone, black, white, brown, yellow, men, women, non-gender specific, it's obvious that he meant so many things to so many people. When Tony introduced himself to the world, it was in the form of his writing. His book, Kitchen Confidential, basically invented the image we have today of the macho bad boy chef. He was a storyteller and an entertainer, an ambassador from the pirate republic of the kitchen. He was a champion of cooks. And then he grew into a fierce critic of the restaurant culture that he had helped to create. And he really became an advocate for the lesser known and the exploitable people of the world. In a beautiful piece written on the day he died, the New Yorker's Helen Rosner wrote that she had once asked Tony if he was a feminist. He kind of danced around the question until a year or so later, when the Me Too movement was taking hold, he approached her at an event and he said, "Remember when you asked if I was a feminist and I was afraid to say yes? Write this down. I'm a fucking feminist." If I stop to think about it, his story was kind of a roller coaster. It was full of moral compromises that he acknowledged honestly. But in the end, the grand arc of his grand life was obvious, given his heart and mind and his sense of what and who mattered. And so we wanted to take a moment to bring Anthony Bourdain to you in his own words, in an interview where you can hear his remarkable spirit. It's from an earlier moment of his career in 2004, recorded in front of a live audience at the Gourmet Institute in New York City. It was a few years after he'd published Kitchen Confidential, and the house was packed. As our host, Lynn Rosetto Casper, talked to Tony and his friend, the chef Thomas Keller.
I have two tall, rangy men up here, and they are just, I'm going to embarrass you. God, you guys are gorgeous.
Thank you. We love it, too.
No, but I mean, talk about, you know, we always talk about that dinner party you'd have where you can invite anybody from any time or whatever. Well, you two are on my list. I would love an evening of a lot of good wine and a lot of good food and just letting you guys go, letting you rip.
What happens after?
Thomas, it's a family show. And my husband's listening. No, how do you each see each other? I'd be curious, because you are both, no, you both have achieved a tremendous amount of celebrity. You both work in very specific areas. Thomas, how do you see Tony Bourdain?
Well, you know, I love Tony. I love the way he writes. I love his passion. But most of all, I love his honesty about what we do and where we came from and how far we've actually come in the past two decades, three decades as an industry and as chefs in particular and as cooks. And it's really an accurate history.
All the rough and tumble in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As much as some of us don't want to admit it, I mean, that's kind of where we came from.
Yeah.
How much can you do? You know, how many cigarettes can you smoke? How many beers can you drink? At the same time, you're putting out 300 dinners for whoever. It's really a physical thing.
Yeah, yeah. Tony, how about you? How do you see Thomas?
Well, I'm going to embarrass Thomas, but I think he's the guy. I think he's the best chef in America and possibly the world. Certainly the best meal I've ever had, at a white tablecloth has been at the French Laundry in Napa Valley. I see him as a guy who is practicing the art of cooking at its very highest level. And yet has never lost sight of the importance of soulfulness, of having a sense of humor, of context, of all the other important elements in a great meal. And it's one of the things that really distinguishes him from other three-star Michelin chefs, for instance.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, makes him better.
Can I hug him?
You can hug him. Go ahead. Hug him. Hug him. I love to know how people come to do what they do, because I think most people in the food business, most of them did not start out to do what they ended up doing with most of their lives. Now, Tony, you're a writer and a very gifted one, and I think you've been writing most of your life, right?
Absolutely wrong.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I started very, very late in life. I would never have been able to become a writer had I not become a fairly useful cook and professional restaurant person. I mean, the same ethic that any good qualities I have, any good work ethic that I might have, any stories, any voice, all of that came directly from my first job as a dishwasher and my long, slow progress up the ladder in restaurants. I mean, I really started writing in 95, 96, failed spectacularly initially, forgot all about it, and then on the basis of an obnoxious over-testosterone memoir, you know my name.
Yeah. How did you first get that job as the dishwasher? I mean, what got you into the restaurant as opposed to?
I was a rotten kid. I didn't have any respect for anyone else. I had no respect for myself. My roommates got sick of me loafing on vacation, and they got me a summer job washing dishes. Mm-hmm. And I looked around and I said, for various reasons, I like this business. I like this lifestyle. I like this. I want to be a member of this tribe. It was the first time that I went home with something to feel proud about. It was the first bunch of people I met whose respect was important to me. And I went home feeling like a champion. I was a very happy dishwasher. And just the cooks got, more free liquor and better girls.
Now it comes down to it. Now it comes down to it. But I think that makes a great deal of sense, because the rewards sometimes are not the ones that you're told you should be looking for.
The love of food snuck up on me. The pride in my profession, all of that came later. I fell in love with the lifestyle first.
Mm-hmm. Now, Thomas, you didn't set out to go to restaurant school. How did you come to food?
My mother. I mean, how do we all come to food? My mother ran restaurants when I was a child, and it was something that, as being the youngest of five boys, she was back in her career, and I would go to the restaurant after school because that's where my mother was. And she would set me in front of the dishwasher, and I thought it was such a fascinating thing. You put something in that was dirty, and 30 seconds later, it came out clean. I mean, this was an amazing thing to a young boy. So growing up in that back of the house role was something that I always did. Even though when I graduated from high school and going on to college, I really didn't want to be involved in the restaurant business. But of course, there was job security there. My mother wouldn't fire me.
Yeah.
And eventually, the chef cook, the one man guy, was leaving. It was a private club, and she said, watch what he does for the next 2 weeks, and you can have his job. And I said, wow, that's really interesting. And that's kind of what happened.
Had you ever cooked?
Not really, no.
But I understand you would call your brother?
I would call my brother, who's 18 months older than I was, who was actually, in a career path to become a chef. And if I needed to have any kind of opinion or any kind of direction at all, Joseph would give that to me at that time. And then realizing after 2 years in that role that it was something that I started to really, again, like, because you could see results. I mean, you knew when you put something in the pan how it was going to come out. Mm-hmm. And then that instant gratification, that instant satisfaction about performing a certain task and seeing the results almost immediately was something that I really kind of embraced and I enjoyed very much. And the group of us decided one summer just to all take off. And the other great thing about being in the restaurant industry is you can go anywhere you want and get a job. So we all headed to Newport, Rhode Island for the tall ships and the bicentennial and ended up working there. I went back the following year, and that's when I met a gentleman who became my mentor. And he was the one that really kind of made the connection for me. It was an emotional connection about cooking.
This?
His name
who
was Roland Hennen, and he was working at the Dunes Club in Narragansett, Rhode Island. But he made that connection. It was about really giving to somebody else something that was so basic, but also could be so pleasurable and really bring that instant gratification, satisfaction of doing the function, bringing it full circle. Mm-hmm. And watching somebody enjoy that.
Yeah, I know both of you. You've mentioned your mother. And Thomas, in your first cookbook, The French Laundry, the first paragraphs of the introduction talk about your mother, but something that had me curious. You say your mother taught you to clean house.
Right.
And that was a very important part of how you became whatever you are now.
I mean, neurotic.
But how did your mother play into this? I mean, obviously she gave you a first job.
It was the repetition. It was, again, being a cook is about, everybody has this view of it's a glamorous lifestyle. Really, I mean, it's about repetition, to be able to do the same thing day in and day out, and be challenged by that, mm-hmm. which is very important, and try to do it better than you did it yesterday. And certainly as a young child, we had, all the brothers, we all had our chores to do. Mine was cleaning the bathroom, and how to do that in a way that was, every week. And that was my chore. I had to do it. So I had to find some compelling, some challenging aspects about it and how to do it better each day. And I think those work ethics of repetition was something that I really got from my mother. And worked, again, it was all coincidence, but it played right into being a cook.
And what about you, Anthony? How is your mother? Has your mother played in your career?
My mother cooked well both parents sort of insisted on shoving my brother and myself into eating well and widely. And that certainly resonated later on when I found myself in the business and that moment when I started to realize I liked it. But I have to kind of echo what Thomas is saying, that this sense of order, repetition, order, it seems sadly lacking in the lives of so many people who come to the restaurant business, and yet we find in the restaurant business, the only order that the order that we need, perhaps, the only kind of order that we would accept. As you probably know, that the kind of personalities who are attracted to the restaurant business are fairly uncontrollable, often outside of the restaurant business. But for whatever reason, that the hierarchy, the repetition, the instant gratification, the control systems, those are all very comforting for some reason to many of us.
Both of you have traveled a long path. You both started out cooking in kitchens, and you've both reached international celebrity in different ways, but it's still the core of it is what happens on a plate in different ways. How do you, it's a philosophical question, but how essentially do you keep that core that initially started all of this, that core that keeps you going? I write, and when the writing is really going well, when I've gotten out of my own way, I almost envision like a river running from my stomach. It's interesting, the part of the anatomy, but it's this flow. What I want to know is, how do you stay in touch with that? With four restaurants and, both, you're on both coasts and cookbooks and celebrity and you with an incredible success, Tony, with your books, TV, and restaurants.
Well, in my case, I'm working in a very, very narrow classic genre. I run a brasserie, almost no original recipes in the cookbook or at the restaurant. This is probably the type of food I should have been cooking my whole life. I'm very comfortable with it. I think food at its best always is an expression of a personality, a culture, a region, even a time. Mm-hmm. you know, this is mine. I think it would be an egregious error if I were to start trying to become an artist. I'm not. You know, I'm a journeyman chef, and I'm working in a classic model that mirrors my temperament and where I came from and what I love and, you know, who I am.
I would never call you a journeyman anything.
You know, I run a turn and burn steak-free, you know, brasserie.
Okay.
We're about volume.
And Thomas, I think of you and I think of pristine white plates and food that's been, you know, all the extras have been eliminated. But again, where's the well? How do you keep that coming?
Well, for me, it's about the camaraderie, a lot of it, and the collaboration that we have as cooks, but not only as cooks, but as people in the restaurant, whether you're in the kitchen or in the dining room. It's that camaraderie, it's that teamwork, it's that knowing that as you bring everything together, I mean, you begin at 5:30 in the morning and, you know, working for one moment at, you know, to begin at 5:30 at night, mm-hmm. and sometime throughout that night that's going to come together for you, or every time, it depends. But it's, you know, for me, it's being with the group, it's being with the people.
But now your staff is spread around the country because you have Per Se in New York, you have French Laundry in California, and you're also in Las Vegas. How does that exchange happen now?
I miss them desperately. This is something that this is the next challenge. How can we communicate, and how can we collectively collaborate on things that we want to work on? You know, that is our challenge. And as I was saying earlier, it may take a while, but at some point it'll become evident to me in the way we're going to collaborate together to bring back that collective team effort that was so wonderful when we were all together at the French Laundry. Remember, the staff that's in Vegas or at Per Se was a staff that was, we were all together at French Laundry for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And we do miss each other desperately. We talk on the phone and we email one another, but it's that spontaneous idea, that spontaneous moments of sitting around at 1 o'clock in the morning having a glass of wine and throwing out an idea on the table and having the person next to you come up with something else. And it's really about being cooks. It's not about being a chef or being a leader at that moment. It's just about a bunch of people sitting around talking about food.
Yeah. What's going to happen if?
Yeah.
I just like to say that the greatest thing about, touch on something Thomas said, that I think one of the greatest things about being in this business is that in the world of chefs and cooks, there are only 2 degrees of separation. We all know each other, or we know somebody who knows somebody, and the camaraderie, as mm-hmm. you travel more and more in a very increasingly transient business where people do stages and apprenticeships around the world, you know, you bump into people you know and mutual friends. It's like being in a mafia. It's great.
Tony, do you think people are born to cook?
No, I think you can be born to eat well. You can come from a culture where eating is important, where everybody around you takes food seriously, and where dining or eating is a mm-hmm. joyous central experience to a family or a culture. Cooks are made. I love that. I quote the Jean-Louis Paladin story where some credulous journalist is asking Jean-Louis Paladin, you know, oh, Jean-Louis, you know, when did you decide to become a chef? You know, why did you decide to become a chef? You know, I guess, assuming that he would answer, oh, I was always, from infancy, I dreamed of white truffles and sea urchins redolent of the sea and, you know, wild mushrooms and smelling of peat and deep forest. In fact, he turned around and said, Madame, my parents sold me into slavery. So it happens to you.
Yeah, and also, you've talked about in your books the real world of who is cooking that elegant, you know, the French food or the fusion or whatever. In that kitchen is not necessarily somebody who was feasting on white truffles. And
the entire restaurant industry in the United States would collapse overnight without the Mexicans and Ecuadorians who came here with no cooking experience whatsoever and started as our dishwashers and porters. It's one of the things I just loathe about the Beard House. You go to the Beard Awards and you look out, and it's that you haven't seen so many white people since the last George Wallace ran for president. Glad I got that off my chest. It's been cooking a long time.
I sense that, and I'm glad for you. I want to get a picture of how both of you work. So here's the setup. It's Friday night. You're in the middle of the worst part of the rush. I walk into your kitchen. Thomas, what would be my first impression?
Well, hopefully you're impressed with what you see. Hopefully that, you know, we're professionals at what we do. We've been doing it for a long time. You're going to walk into our kitchen, wherever it is, whether it's French Laundry, Bouchon, or Per Se, and be impressed in an inspiring way. And what I mean by that is looking at a group of people that are collectively working together for a common goal, not just in the kitchen, but in the entire restaurant. Uh-huh.
Is it noisy? I mean, is it?
It shouldn't be noisy. No. We try to keep the chaos. I mean, you've heard it before. It's controlled chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. I mean, chefs are control freaks, are they not, Tony? Yeah. I mean, it's the root of who we are. But you don't want to have a situation where it's chaos in the kitchen.
Leal, Friday night.
Slightly more civilized at Thomas. Okay, Friday night. Well, I'm cursing affectionately. Affectionately. Uh-huh. I'm probably on my second margarita. They're playing Mexican hardcore over by the grill station. Uh-huh. The busboys are squeezing behind me. It looks chaotic, but the food is coming up. It's going out on time. It's going to the right customers. It's properly cooked, and we're not getting any plates. No, there are no returns coming back from the floor. So it is about control, but it's two very different control systems. Mm-hmm. I tend to foster a us versus them mentality in the kitchen that I find very useful in team spirit. You know, it's the dust boat principle of restaurant management. Team building, I think they call it.
But the result's the same. I think that's the important thing. So there's many ways to get to the to a successful result.
We have slightly lower standards.
Tony Bourdain, Thomas Keller, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lynn here. Now, here's the thing about Tony Bourdain. That humor usually came from his own take on himself. And then there was his smarts. The breadth of his mind bordered on stunning. And so was the bad boy's love of danger. And Bourdain, the mouthy humanitarian. We saw what evolved when he took on one of media's sacred cows. The typical travel show, with its glossed-up reality, no gritty real-life glimpses allowed. And where those interesting locals, who are nothing like us, are treated as curiosities. Listen to his evolution over the years. What quickly fell away was him taking on that quote-unquote interviewer role with its list of preset questions and that careful distance from his subject. Instead, Tony talked with other people. He listened, and he asked them to teach him. Tony dug into himself. He challenged himself, and he told us about it. Like doing a return trip to the Khmer Rouge village to see if the pain of losing a woman he loved that he felt there on his first trip was still waiting to hit him again. His truthfulness freed so many people. I feel lucky to have had so much time with him. Tony, Godspeed.
That was Lynn Rosetto Casper, and the conversation between Lynn, Thomas Keller, and Tony Bourdain was recorded at the Gourmet Institute in 2004. Thanks for being with us today. Our digital teams pulled together a collection of conversations that we've had with Tony over the years, and you can find them at splendidtable.org. You know, mental illness comes in lots of forms, and even if suicide is not an immediate threat, there are lots of ways to get and to give help. The National Alliance on Mental Illness is the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization, and you can learn more about them at NAMI.org. That's NAMI.org. But if you are or know someone who's having thoughts about suicide, please know that there is always a trained counselor ready to talk to you 24/7 at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Their number is 1-800-273-TALK. And if hearing from other people who deal with depression might help you feel that you're not alone, there's a podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression. It's about handling the disease with humor, and right now they have an episode that's all about how to get help. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today. Consider reaching out to your loved ones to gently remind them that you're there for them. And I'm Francis Lamb.
Oh. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.